thing.
Right. Yeah, not public takeover.
All right. We would like to thank our guest for being here tonight.
And if y'all want to say your name and let people know how the website to go to vote on this Compassionate Change District, please do.
My name is Fran Michelle. The website that you should go to contact city council members and let them know that you support compassionate change rather than business interests is ccdpdx.org.
My name is Benjamin. I'd like to thank Ibrahim and Lisa for this amazing opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that is ccdpdx.org. And you do not have to live in this neighborhood. If you feel compassionate about it, anywhere in the city of Portland, please sign, go to the website, ccdpdx. And Right to Survive will be having a meeting tomorrow at Join off of 81st Avenue in Portland and out on the east side. It starts at 5, goes from 5 to 7. If you would like to talk more about this or have stories that you'd like to share, please come to our meeting again, 5 to 7 tomorrow night at Joint. And our website is www.righttosurvive.org. That's the number 2, righttosurvive.org.
Thank you. I'll come back next month and listen to another show about houselessness in Portland, Oregon.
Thank you.
Remember, be kind.
Feed someone.
Or Right to Survive. On this show, we go to Ground Zero, Portland, Oregon.
Is a proud sponsor of the film screening From Shock to Awe, A Journey of Hope and Transformation, on Thursday, January 10th at the Sunnyside Community House in Portland. From Shock to Awe follows the path of two combat veterans from the Iraq War as they live with post-traumatic stress, lack of effective treatment, and their search for healing and transformation through plant medicine journeys. Again, that's the film screening From Shock to Awe, A Journey of Hope and Transformation, on Thursday, January 10th at 7 p.m. at the Sunnyside Community House, 3520 Southeast Yamhill Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I have a dream. I have a dream. I have a dream.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 33rd Annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast on Monday, January 21st from 8:30 to 10:30 a.m. at the Red Line Hotel on the river at Jansen Beach. King County Councilor Larry Gossett will be the keynote speaker for the Scanner Foundation's 33rd Annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast. Gossett, who was first elected to the King County Council in 1993, served as chair of the entire council in 2007 and 2013. Again, that's the 33rd Annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast on Monday, January 21st from 8:30 to 10:30 a.m. at the Red Lion Hotel on the river at Jansen Beach, 909 North Hayden Island Drive in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good evening. You are tuning in to KBOO 90.7 FM, and up next is Hard Rock, Hard Knock Radio.
Yo, check this out. Hard Knock Radio coming at you, bringing the noise. This is Chuck D, Public Enemy number one, news, views, and hip-hop.
This is Sister Soulja on Hard Knock Radio. Listen closely.
¿Qué pasa, raza? This is Deuce Eclipse, the Hoy Joaquin, your parte chino. Check it out. Listening to Hard Knock Radio. Radio.
Hey, this is Patrice Rushen, and whenever I'm in the Bay Area and I need good information and great radio, it's all about Hard Knock Radio.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. We love talking to, you know, this gentleman here out of USF, University of San Francisco, political scientist, political analyst, and author. His name is Dr. James Taylor. And I wanted to talk to you because yesterday we had the inaugurations. We saw people being sworn in locally here at City Hall, the new makeup of the city council. We also saw the re-inauguration of the mayor. And we just saw the governor, you know, become inaugurated. So there's a changing of the guard. And, of course, the Democrats are now taking over the House of Representatives. But the government is shut down. So before we even get into the political landscape and what that means with certain factions now holding power, just your thoughts and how do you see things going with this government shutdown? And I'm asking this because some people are saying that if it continues much longer, it will play into Donald Trump's hands, because then he'll just have this, you know, he'll be ruling with executive power.
Now, thank you, Davey, and I want to wish your audience a happy 2019. It's really, really perplexing, because Donald Trump ultimately is already at the bottom. I mean, his approval ratings are at about 39%, some of the lowest in presidential history. So he can only go up. So for him to wallow in this mess can only take Nancy Pelosi down. Chuck Schumer, I have no interest in, but Nancy Pelosi, he could actually take her down, even though she's riding the crest and riding the wave and seems to be the alternative voice of reason in politics. It seems like if the Democrats aren't careful, engaging and taking Trump seriously on this inane and bad idea of a wall, then they ultimately get dirty too. In other words, Trump is like a child playing in his own poop and then asking everyone else to play in it with him. And Nancy Pelosi, unfortunately, has to get dirty because this is where he is. This is what he's doing. And because he's president, he's an important baby, if you will. We all have to pay attention to what he's doing. And so as he decides to play in his diaper, the rest of us are getting all the stuff on us.
Tonight, the president is going to speak. He's giving a national address where he makes the case for the wall, which is an unusual situation. I don't know if Obama did that for his Obamacare, for the Affordable Care Act. But with that being said, many folks are saying that we are now seeing a press corps that is demonized, that has now been the butt of jokes, fake news, all that sort of stuff. You know, they have a label that's attached to them, that they're giving credence to a guy who will then lie and say there's a catastrophe at the border, there's an emergency, a national emergency, and that's and they're gonna give this, you know, the seriousness, you know, the credibility or validation that you said Nancy Pelosi does. So how does that weigh in with the press being complicit right now?
No, the American press has never owned up to creating this monster. Donald Trump is national American media's Frankenstein, and he's come back to haunt it. And of course, the question is to what extent. But they created this man. He got $3 billion in free ad buy time during the 2016 election. So he didn't have to pay $3 billion worth of airtime that he got just because of the man bites dog nature of his personality that brings everyone into sort of a shock. And so Trump's conduct is one that drives ratings for all of the national media. So they have an incentive to keep this show, I like to say this S show, going, and incentivizing it, because they've never gotten this kind of attention. And he knows that's all he can read is Nielsen ratings and other kinds of ratings. So for him, this is all working well. The country's watching. He's excited about it. But again, he has not pivoted to actually governing affirmatively in this country in terms of a domestic agenda outside of deconstructing the Obama administration and policies. And so Donald Trump is someone who is sort of bringing the country to a place where only he can come out sort of on top. And what I mean by that is the decency, the decorum, the civility, the normal conduct of government and political leaders is still respected by everyone else except Donald Trump. And so we're still living by the old rules, and we're still behaving by the old rules, and we even are going to react to Sister Tlaib when she referred to impeaching the MF Donald Trump. People pushed back on her like she had done something that was unacceptable in American politics, even in a time of Donald Trump's grab him here and, you know, S-hole city, countries and SOB football players. Even in that environment, the normal politics is still in place for the rest of us. So we are all still, if I said something inappropriate right now, the old rules would discipline me. That's what Donald Trump relies on. He relies on our decency and his indecency. And because we're decent, we tend to react in ways that would be normal. Like this was John Kennedy, or this was, say, George Herbert Walker Bush. But this is Donald Trump. And since he doesn't respect the rules, that's the advantage he has, is that the rest of us do.
You know, it's interesting. Two people that I noticed that publicly he's never really responded to, and both are willing to get dirty in the mud with that. One is Eminem. Right. Remember, you know, or anybody else who's of worth who's gone after him, he's had something to say, mm-hmm. but he didn't get into a war of words with him. Right. Mm-hmm. And the other one is Lonzo Ball.
Mm.
You know, after he got his sons back from China, he pretty much was like, yeah, that was what you're supposed to do, and kept it moving.
Right.
And I think he understood, like, this dude doesn't really care, and he can go there and be just as outlandish that he's courting the media, and like he would love.
Yeah.
Nothing more than to be engaged, so he's not going to engage.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting that this political arena that you talked about that has this sort of unspoken decorum that everybody needs to adhere to is also something that may be an undoing for a lot of people, because folks are reacting to the outlandishness more than they are the civility.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think you see more and more people sort of reacting to Donald Trump's behavior, and it's sort of at a point where people are just sort of, I assume at some point this country gets bored with this whole stick, his whole routine. It's just sort of like, okay, we've seen this. Now that could help him get reelected, because we've gotten used to this pattern. But at some point, I assume Americans would get bored with Donald Trump's behavior. But I think the thing that keeps him looking is the same thing that, you know, takes us to the zoo to go see the animals, or helps us stop at a car accident. We want to see the blood, even though we don't really want to see it. We just want to see it. And that's what Donald Trump, I think, is the, you know, that's the draw to him, is he's an accident, an ongoing presidential accident. And people want to understand, how is this going to play out? And I think that's where the old systems, the standard systems will kick in. And I think the person to watch going forward in 2019 is Mitch McConnell, because ultimately he's going to have to go to Nancy Pelosi and say, we need to impeach this president. It can't happen the other way around.
Let me ask you this. With the Democrats in Congress, what should we be looking for? And what do you think a public that has disdain and concern about a Trump needs to do with this particular party, which, you know, in many ways is very corporatized, you know, so you may be trading in fascism for corporate tyranny, but, you know, people may be more comfortable and feel they have a better fight under the Democrats than they do under the Republicans. But what do you see coming down this next year?
I say Joe Biden is capable of, you know, standing toe to toe with Donald Trump and being that guy who can take the insults and deliver them back.
So you're talking about in the race, but I'm talking about with the Congress. Forget about the presidential race.
Okay.
What should we expect with the Congress right now?
I think that Nancy Pelosi is going to have a modifying effect on all of the energy that we've seen reacting to Donald Trump from the grassroots. I think Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic centrists themselves are as much an obstacle to a really progressive agenda when they, for example, yesterday signed against the, you know, they're taking an oppositional position against the Green New Deal.
The Ocasio-Cortez thing.
Right, I'm calling it the Green Deal instead of the Green New Deal, but the Green Deal. And, you know, and this whole question of, what was it called, as it related to pay,
Single payer?
And it wasn't single payer. It was a system yesterday that the Democrats had signed off on, but it was actually a policy position that undermines the ability of you know, the progressive agenda to be carried out. But in short, I think, and I've said this before she became speaker, that Nancy Pelosi stands to be as much a obstacle to a progressive agenda as the right wing would, but for different reasons. Her opposition is one because that's not the way the House works. It's not, even though it's expected to be the least disciplined of all the branches of government, which is because you got 435 people, and that's why the Speaker is so powerful. It's still the House of Representatives, and Nancy Pelosi wants it to behave in a way that will ensure Democratic majorities going forward for the next two or three cycles. So she's going to try to make sure that the progressive element doesn't dominate the agenda of the Democrats, pushing it further and further left. And that's where Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and, you know, Ayanna Pressley and others come into play, is they really want to go left. And, you know, where Bernie took the whole system in 2016, the electoral system, that's where they want to go, but the Democrats don't want to go there. And I've been arguing since 2016 that that's the winning ticket for the
right.
Democrats.
Would you say going left would be the winning ticket?
Go Bernie, but go younger. And I don't mean to sound like an ageist. I apologize if I do. But again, I think you need to repackage Bernie's message in a younger woman or a younger man, and energize that message. It's not Beto O'Rourke. Do not confuse Beto O'Rourke for Bernie Sanders because he's young and, you know, got your interest as it related to winning in Texas against Ted Cruz. You know, his politics are center right. You know, as a blue dog, a yellow dog Democrat, he's got to be conservative in a red state like Texas. So he is not the answer. He's just someone that the media will get behind to make excited. And then we'll find the media establishment will pick a couple of people like Joe Biden and Beto O'Rourke and tell the rest of us to get behind it. And then when you take the top off, the policies don't really lead to a sense of a new phase or new stage of American politics. With Joe Biden coming in with the centrist Democrat policies, it's the same old, going back to Bill Clinton.
So it seems like, with that in mind, what should people who are listening do? There's a lot of people say, I'm not bothered with any of the two parties, but should people play a role in pushing any of this at this point in time?
I think so. I think there's so many different fronts that people can address and support and attend to, that politics is just one tool in the toolkit. Economics is another. Educational development is another. Environment is another. You know, seniors are another. All of the different social demands and needs are there. And I think too often, you know, most people who engage in politics only see themselves as being powerful if they are connected to a party. But with the internet and with community-based groups, with young people, there's plenty of opportunity to organize offline and still impact the political process. Again, I'm thinking more about community-based programming, community-based efforts. Like, in my fantasy world, the Black Lives Matter movement would just sort of go under radar and commit all of those young people's energies that we've seen, you know, for the last 3 years or 4 years to black community development. Of course, we need money for that, but I'd love to see all of a sudden the Black Lives Matter movement only deal with Black America and stop talking to white America and stop appealing to white America, even the police, and focus mainly on Black community development affirmatively. Now, maybe this is my little, I consider myself a neo-Garveyite of late, but I'm thinking more that we should be thinking more about community
development. But BLM has always been Black focused. I mean, the people that I know are pretty Black focused, and they intersect with other struggles.
Absolutely.
But I think, you know, I don't want to get too far down the road with that. But with that being said, let me just ask you this. You mentioned the Green Deal. Mm-hmm. Should the Green Deal be something that people really pressure? If you're here and you know that a Nancy Pelosi is in the way of that, and she's right down the street or across the bridge, should people really get behind that and push and expand it? Or do you just kind of, you know what, that's a Democratic thing, I'm not going to bother at all?
Well, if you look at Newt Gingrich with the contract with America, that was from the above. That was Newt Gingrich's agenda, and he led it, and then the grassroots of the right wing followed it and they got in 1994 and impeached Clinton in 1998. There's no reason why Nancy Pelosi, who's, you know, potentially one of the greatest speakers of the House in the 20th century, can't take a page out of that book and do the same thing. Set the agenda, let it be a radical agenda, and yeah, win people over. But Nancy Nancy Pelosi won't be committed like Newt Gingrich. Newt Gingrich was committed to Republican development and Democratic underdevelopment and backwardness. Nancy Pelosi is committed to both.
What I was asking Dr. James Taylor, knowing that Nancy Pelosi is going to be an obstacle mm-hmm. for a progressive agenda, mm-hmm. and we know that Alicia Cortez, mm-hmm. you know, has put forth the Green Deal. Mm-hmm. Do people that are listening, do they jam up a Nancy Pelosi who is kind of undermining that and not really committing to that agenda? Do we have a responsibility to lobby and agitate and advocate, or do we just say, you know what, these parties are too far gone, too far corrupt, and, you know, and let's just do something else?
Now, I would say it depends on where you are. In California, absolutely. You can agitate, and demand that the Democrats under Nancy Pelosi move further left around healthcare, around single payer, around universal healthcare, around education, community college, and things of that sort. So I think that's one of the things that can be done, is that, you know, people can advocate and agitate around those particular kinds of issues. But in the long run, I think people have to understand that in order to be effective, in some places you push Nancy Pelosi far left. But in West Virginia, you don't, because in West Virginia, you got a yellow dog or a blue dog Democrat. They have to play the game of conservatism in order to hold on to the committees. And that's the problem, is those of us in the blue territories want all Democrats to behave the same. Well, if you're in West Virginia, Arkansas, or even, say, Texas, and you're a Democrat, you're probably going to be a little bit more conservative than you are in California. So what my point is, in California, sure, push her further left. But in West Virginia, don't. In Texas, you can't. In New York, you can. It all depends on where you are in terms of the party and its ideology in that region, in the southeast, in the northeast, in the heartland, and in the west. You have basically five or six different Democratic parties, not including the different black Democratic fronts. And, for example, I've said this on your show before, that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Brother Gilliam down in Florida and Stacey Abrams in Atlanta and in Georgia, they were not Obama acolytes. They weren't Obama disciples, and they weren't quite Bernie either, but they were reacting, I think, to Trump, and they're ideologically closer to Bernie, not Obama or, say, Kamala. They're closer to Martin Luther King ideologically, believing that the welfare state should be mobilized en masse to attend to the myriad issues that confront people. The Democratic centrists that come with Bill Clinton, Chuck Robb, who was the son-in-law of LBJ, and Al Gore, and Gray Davis here in California. Those men, and Harold Ford, those men created the DLC. And that is the Democratic Leadership Council that has moved the party to the right. So Manning Marable, who's now gone, said that Bill Clinton was the most conservative president, Democratic president we had since Woodrow Wilson. Mm. And so that's the dominant ideology of the Democratic Party now, is the Clinton-Obama centrism that is far removed from Martin Luther King and FDR. So Obama and Kamala are closer to Ronald Reagan. So is Nancy Pelosi right now, anyway. I assume all these people really have real liberal tendencies in their hearts. But politically speaking, in terms of politics, in terms of winning, they de-racialize their politics to make sure that they don't offend the Reagan Democrats. And that's this whole game. That's what this whole game is right now. And I've been in this discussion where a lot of people are looking at me like I'm talking French when I say that Donald Trump doesn't have a real base. And what I mean by that is that the base that we've given to Donald Trump voted for Barack Obama in 2008 and 12. They voted for Ronald Reagan in the 1980s. These are nothing but the Reagan Democrats. These are the same people that Nixon was trying to appeal to with his Southern strategy. This is nothing new. So for people to talk about Donald Trump's base, his base just got beat by 3 million votes in 2016 and got beat by 8 million votes in November. 11 million votes, the base got whooped in the last two elections, and everyone keeps talking about Donald Trump's base like it's real. And then you see women, suburbanites, people throughout, military, walking away from Donald Trump. High school educated white women are walking away from Donald Trump. So whatever, even his cabinet, people leaving him every single day. And yet the media continues to empower this notion that Donald Trump has a base. And I'm saying, where is it? I'm not. You can get any 50 idiots to show up in America and sit, or 200 people to sit up in a hotel, or sit up in a stadium and let the president yell and scream and be all caught up in the crowd. But where is Donald Trump's base really? Not these individual racists who are running around doing violence like the poor Nia Wilson here in Oakland. That ain't the base. Where is Donald Trump's political base? And if you ask somebody to show you his political base, all they're going to do is show you the same thing that Mitt Romney said back when he ran, that the country is basically split 47-47. That's every Republican's base. That's every Republican's base. So Donald Trump's base is the same. The people who are Donald Trump's base today were the base of George Bush before that, and they'll become the base of the next Republican when Donald Trump is no longer president. And yet the media continues to hold up this fictitious, this manufactured notion that Donald Trump has this base. And if it is a base, where is it? And how come we don't feel its power outside of the media telling us that it's important? He continues to play to his base. They keep telling us. And I keep saying, well, where is Donald Trump's base?
Right. You know, that's something to definitely think about. And we're going to have to revisit that a little bit and see if that base really manifests itself. You know, I mean, one way that you determine it is through elections. Others will be through the type of impact. Maybe the base is very small, but right now we're about to hear a speech about a wall. And there will be a reaction about a wall. So his base may be small, but his base is, you know, those corporate media outlets that are incentivized to broadcast him and carry his water and be stenographers. His base are some of these folks that are going to benefit from a tax cut. So there are some very powerful people that I think numerically are in low numbers, but yet they're yielding a lot of influence. And, you know, we're going to have to check for that. Dr. James Taylor, we appreciate you taking time out this afternoon, giving us a little bit to think about as the new year unfolds and Congress is, you know, what, their third or fourth day into, you know, the activities, and we'll see where it goes. We're going to take a break here on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
Hard Knock. Turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program. Turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man. Innovation, stimulating new conversation. Anything else is just imitation, simulation. Step into the zone, the Bay Area zone. Hard Knock Radio, let's go. Big shout out to Nita and Davey D. Yeah, right, feel me. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kind of crazy though. Oakland, stand up.
Stand up.
Ensemble, Big Night Wolves.
Kansas City.
Yeah.
Bellevue. Come on.
Check out.
Why every knob just think they hard knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost of the fee? Hating that they made they beats, trying to eat to the belly from the steel gray beats. Say please, maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making a speech. Say the beast and the lovers I named with a please. Hey, there's some shade on your name in the street. Let's go, eating David D.
Real Talk Radio.
You are now rocking with the best in the West.
Yes, Coach. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
Let's go.
Baltimore, who can forget
New York, New York, city of dreams. Everything in New York ain't always what it says.
Chicago, murder capital. These young boys will put a cap in you.
In Oakland, fire burning. Capitalism, wheels are turning.
Los Angeles, dangerous. All my gangsters bang to this.
Miami, that's the bottom. Justice system, keep on rocking.
The DMV, what it be? We protesting in the streets.
Seattle, they get at you. Front line of the battle.
In Houston, what it do? They be after me.
And Malcolm, who got the most bombs, who got the most drones, who got the most deaths, who's tapping cell phones, who the terrorists, you think I'm out of my mind, you need a therapist, it's a sign of the times, this is America, Great Britain and France, it's getting scarier, hysteria, it's hysterical,
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. This morning, many of us woke up and we saw an article in the Advocate magazine that talked about the latest killing or death that has occurred on the premises of a very prominent individual, prominent in the Democratic Party, somebody who's out of West Hollywood, a big donor to the Democratic Party. His name is Ed Buck. And what makes this story very disturbing is that this latest victim is somebody who was said to have been drugged, was found dead in this gentleman's house, and this is the third time this has happened. And folks are wondering, how and why is this happening? What is being done about it? And what are the issues surrounding this? And joining us on the phone is a journalist and somebody who is definitely keeps her finger and her feet on the pulse. She's also somebody who's running for office right now, so she has her hands full. Her name is Jasmine Kanick. And we wanted to talk to you about this because this goes beyond just the headlines in the article that we read about. So maybe you can walk us through it because you've been covering some of this stuff almost from day one.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I want to say that this is the second death of a black person in Ed Buck's house, not the third. Although, if he's not arrested, prosecuted, and convicted, there probably will be a third one. I've been covering the story of just the death of Jamel Moore at Ed Buck's apartment in West Hollywood pretty much from the beginning. And that happened in July of 2017. And Jamel Moore was a 26-year-old black gay male who died of a crystal meth overdose in Ed Buck's West Hollywood apartment. And when Jamel Moore died, the sheriff's department and the coroner's office basically labeled it as an accidental meth overdose and closed the case. And then what happened is I published excerpts from Jamel Moore's diary from his journal that talked about his relationship with Ed Buck and how Ed Buck had been the first one to give him meth, to inject meth into him, and how Ed Buck had gotten him hooked on meth and the relationship that he had with Ed Buck, just in terms of him being scared of Ed Buck. And basically, you know, the young man was clearly depressed and he was clearly scared of Ed Buck, but he was very vulnerable because he, you know, he was homeless, he was young, he was black, he was gay, and, you know, on the streets of West Hollywood and Los Angeles. And, you know, his last journal entry was at the beginning of December of 2016, and he was dead by July 2017. And so when we published the excerpts from his journal, the sheriff's department was forced to open up a homicide investigation. And that homicide investigation was really a sham. They didn't really do anything. Jamel's family attorney, Nana Jumpsy, his mother, Ms. Leticia Nixon, and his friends, we did most of the investigating. We did most of the work. We found all of the witnesses. We did basically the investigation. And then right before, maybe a day before, they had to make a decision on whether or not to file criminal charges. The district attorney's office came back in July of 2018 and said there wasn't enough admissible evidence to prosecute Ed Buck for manslaughter or murder, not even the treasure trove of drugs he had in his house, for nothing. And then 6 months later, we have the death of another black man in Ed Buck's house of an overdose.
What do you think is the reason that there hasn't been such a vigorous investigation around Ed Buck, considering the circumstances, drug paraphernalia being found in his house, the diary that was written by Jamel, a lot of things that I think if it had been me or you or somebody else would put us in the crosshairs of law enforcement, and it would be very difficult for us to extract ourselves. Why was he able to you know, why do you think this, you know, there wasn't that sort of follow through with Ed Buck?
So let's be really clear and call it for what it is. You and I know if we had just one dead body wind up in our house over an overdose of illegal drugs, we would have been detained and probably arrested, and we may or may not have gotten bail. And probably wouldn't, if we got bail, we probably wouldn't have had the money to pay the bail to get out. So I think in this particular situation, there's a intersection of race and class. There's the issue of influence. There's the issue of the fact that he is a prominent Democratic donor in California, that, you know, he's given money to everyone from our new governor, Gavin Newsom. He's given money to our DA. He's given money to Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti. He has spread his money and his wealth around, and it looks like he has made a good investment because he's still at home. And I think, as a matter of fact, I know that if it had been the other way around and Ed Buck had been found dead in Jamel Moore's house, Jamel Moore would have been detained and arrested. So I think, again, it's the value that we put on Black lives, and the fact that white privilege is alive and well. I would not be able to explain a dead body away in my house, no matter what color the body was. But on two occasions, this white man has been able to just explain to the coroner and the sheriff's department that he had nothing to do with the person dying, and they have wheeled out a body and left him in his apartment.
You know, one of the sad tendencies that seem to happen here is when we have certain types of people who are victims to any sort of crime or premature death, they are often blamed. We're seeing that play out in the R. Kelly situation. Just a surprising number of people are out there saying it's the girl's fault, you know, even if they're 13, 14. When the tapes came out of R. Kelly, they tended to blame them. When it comes to folks in the LGBT community, there tends to be either an erasing, an invisibilityism around them, or they're blamed. How are you seeing this, you know, for the work that you do? Is that a continuation in that path, or are times changing? And if not, what do we need to do to move things in a more forward direction?
So, absolutely. I mean, you know, in this particular case, there is a lot of blame the victim, right? There's a lot of assumptions because some of these young men engaged in sex work or were escorts or were homeless or HIV positive or on drugs that they deserved what happened to them in Ed Buck's house. I feel pretty safe saying that after, of course, interviewing at least a dozen young men who have dealt with Ed Buck, that none of these men ever agreed to go over to his house and die. And that you have to, people who are in doubt or who are wanting to blame the victim need to put themselves in their shoes. You have to remember, we're dealing with this is a population mostly of young Black gay men who are very vulnerable, right? Because they're homeless in some cases, they're on drugs. And remember, you know, Ed Buck is furnishing these young men drugs. Jamel Moore is a perfect example of someone who had not done crystal meth and who Ed Buck gave crystal meth to and turned him into an addict. Okay? So no matter what your personal beliefs are, you know, no one agrees to be killed. No one agrees, you know, to be given drugs and sent into an overdose and eventually, you know, die. So, you know, we have to stop. You know, even in my own personal life, look, I look at everything, you know, for what it is, you know, and in some situations, you know, I have said, well, you know, they were gangbanging or they were this and they were that. In this particular situation, for me, it's very clear. These are young, impressionable, vulnerable young men who needed money or needed a place to stay or needed food or whatever, and this is a man who made it his business to prey on them, to get them and to snatch the life from them. You know, when I think of Ed Buck's apartment, I think of the movie Get Out. You know, I do. I literally think of the movie Get Out. I think, you know, that he is a menace to society, but because he is white, people are willing to look the other way and make excuses for him. More excuses for him than they're willing to make for the young black men who are his victims. And that, to me, is sad.
Jasmine Kanick is on the phone line with us, and we're talking about this situation, horrible situation in Los Angeles, and it's coming to light in the Advocate magazine, but it's something that she's been covering for a while, involving Democratic donor Ed Buck and the second death of a young black male found in his house. You know, I want to put this into context a little bit, because in the height, we're in the middle of the Me Too movement, and many people are starting to lose their positions, though the prominence for saying things, having some sort of transgression that has made folks feel uncomfortable and unsafe, definitely folks who have assaulted. And so the point is that, especially with this Democratic Party, we've seen this play out. You know, Al Franken, the senator out of Minneapolis or Minnesota, you know, there were accusations that he said some things and made some gestures, and he was out of there. And it came with a chorus of fellow Democrats saying, you did wrong. You did something that was morally reprehensible. You need to be out. We don't want to associate you with that. It would seem to me that somebody like an Ed Buck, the minute you find out that, wait a second, you had crystal meth in your house, somebody died, overdose, you know, that seems to me would be something that, you know, I would as a party be saying, we don't want to be associated with that. I mean, the minute that, you know, if for any reason it's something that, you know, your opponents can hold up and say, one of your key donors, you know, is sleeping around with young men and they're dying in his house. That is a liability for the Democratic Party. So how come we haven't seen movement around that with a party that is, you know, as of late has been very aggressive about sanitizing its image?
You know, what's going on with Ed Buck and his abuse and use of young black gay men actually is directly contradicts the Democratic Party's platform, at least allegedly, what they're supposed to support and stand for. I mean, in California, our Democratic Party is already in the middle of a morals and values crisis, and they have all but forgotten black people in this state. But, you know, again, if this had been a white LGBT man, I do not think the party would be holding their tongues the way that they are and wanting, you know, well, let's wait for a thorough investigation. I mean, how many death investigations need to be done before the Democratic Party has something to say about this? Again, I think because this man has really spread his money, I'm not just talking about for people running for governor, for our governor, on down the mayor. I'm in congressional races, in state assembly races, in Senate races. I mean, he has really spread his money around. And, you know, there are a lot of people who are in this business of running for office and in politics who will protect their donors. Now, if you remember, Davey, when Harvey Weinstein started to fall down, they couldn't offload his money fast enough. Everybody was trying to return his money. And they weren't trying to give the money back to Harvey Weinstein. They were trying to give the money back to shelters for women, or places that, you know, helped abused women, or the Time's Up Fund. You know, we made the same call for the people who took money from Ed Buck. We asked them to return his money to a fund to assist his victims, right? Maybe 1% of the people did that. Maybe 1% of the nearly $500,000 in donations from this man came back. And the first person to give their money back was Karen Bass, was Congresswoman Karen Bass, a black woman. Now, and I want to be really clear about this. Ed Buck was not known for giving money to black candidates. I could count on one hand, out of all of his political donations that we've tracked, I could count on one hand the number of black people who got money from him. Okay? So Karen didn't get, wasn't maxed out. It wasn't like it was thousands and thousands of dollars. I think maybe she got $250 from him at one point or something. But he didn't generally give money to black candidates. But again, we as black people always have to be the heart and soul and the conscience of the Democratic Party. So she led the way with returning the money. As a matter of fact, last night when we were in front of Ed Buck's apartment, a couple of council members from West Hollywood showed up and they tried to be out there. And I actually had to call them out and ask them why they were here, because they weren't trying to be out there when Jamel Moore died. And they had gotten so much money from Ed Buck and they refused to return Ed Buck's money. But then when all the news cameras were out there for the second death, they decided they wanted to come out there. And I just wasn't having that. No.
That's real talk right there. You know, what has been his reaction to this? As you mentioned, last night, people were in front of his apartment protesting. This is now starting to get national coverage, especially now that it was in the Advocate. And I know you told me that you got, you know, thousands or hundreds of phone calls right now with people wanting to talk about this. What has been his reaction? Has there been any sort of statement or press release or press conference or what?
No, he has his high-priced attorney out here peddling the same story as before, that Ed Buck was friends with this man and he was just trying to help him, and you know, he was in the bathroom and he had no idea, you know, that the man was on drugs or that he was overdosing, which is almost the exact same story he had his attorney spin when Jamel Moore died. When we were there last night, he was I assume he was home, his lights were on, they went on and off in his apartment. But, you know, it's business as usual for him. I would not be surprised if after we left, some other young man went in there or some man went in there. I wouldn't be surprised if some man went there today. I mean, he shows no signs or willingness of being able to change his behavior, nor does he think he needs to. I think he believes that he's safe, that nothing can happen to him.
You mentioned that he hasn't given too much money to black candidates, and you also noted, and I think people would understand clearly, that black folks are a very crucial part of the Democratic Party. A lot of races had hinged upon the black vote, the black woman vote in particular. And one would wonder if he has this propensity to pick up black young men to take home, but he's not really engaging in the larger black community. I mean, what comes to my is fetishizing. What's the deal? Is this a guy who has a fetish for black men?
Oh, he clearly has a fetish for black men. That's clear, at least to us and the people that we've talked to. He prefers black men in terms of that type of company. In terms of his day-to-day work, no. He doesn't participate in black LGBT causes or even black causes. He's an animal rights activist. He's a white gay activist. He does white gay activist things. But does he champion any black gay causes or black causes? Absolutely not. No, he does not.
With the second death, where do you see things headed right now? And, you know, I mentioned earlier that you yourself were running for office down there in L.A. Does this impact your race, you know, considering that you have spoken out against him? You wrote these articles. You brought attention to the case of Jamel Moore. How does that impact somebody like yourself, who is essentially up against a very powerful, you know, donor? Even though he's not running against you, he's somebody who yields a lot of influence.
Yeah, he does. You know, I made it really clear when I jumped in the race for delegate to the Democratic Party that I was doing it because of what happened to Jamel Moore, and how at the time the chair of the California Democratic Party was Eric Bauman, and he was really close friends with Ed Buck, and he was unwilling to speak out against him or do anything to censor him in the party or to take a position. Eric Bauman has since been dethroned, having been caught up in his own sexual harassment scandal. And we don't have a formal chair. We have an acting chair of the party right now. We'll be delegates are going to be responsible for electing the next chair, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to run for delegate, because I don't want to be a part of a party. Over 77% of Black people in the state of California vote Democratic. I do not want to be blindly voting for a party that doesn't care about the lives of Black people, all Black people. It is not enough to support a hashtag. It is not enough to retweet or share something that says, oh, you know, Black women are great or Black people are great. No, they need to put their money, their vote, their so-called values into play. This is a time when they need to actually stand up. Had this been a trans person, had this been a white gay person, had this been maybe even a Latino gay person, I think the response would have been so different coming out of the California Democratic Party. And so I said that from the beginning when I started campaigning. So I could have never predicted that somebody was going to end up dead at Ed Buck's house. And I'm not trying to use this person's death to get me into office, but I am trying to use it to point out to people that if you don't like the direction the party is going in, and if you don't like how the party refuses to respond to their donors who engage in this type of behavior, you have to get involved at the delegate level. The delegates are responsible for electing the chair of the party. The delegates are responsible for doing the roadmap and designing the platform of the party, which is then what its elected members, you know, people who belong to the city council and the Senate and the Assembly and Congress, then take their cues from the platform in terms of what type of legislation they push forward and what they champion and support. So it really does start at the delegate level. And a lot of people aren't involved in party politics. You know, when I talk to people about running, they're like, I never knew that this was a real thing, that people, you know, had to be elected as delegates. And I'm like, yes, you have to run. The Democratic Party does not publicize it at all, because they like to make sure that their delegates are the kind of people who will say yes or no or look the other way when told to. They don't want activists in the party. You know, they don't want those kind of people. And I'm running to be that person. Yes, I'm going to be the person that says, okay, hey, you want immigration reform as a part of the party's platform? I am all for that. But as a part of immigration reform, we're going to talk about all the Cameroonians, Eritreans, Haitians, and other African and West Indian migrants who are stuck at the Mexican California border as well. We're going to talk about the effect of illegal immigration on Black unemployment in California. Yes, you want immigration reform? We're going to talk about how not all immigrants and migrants come from Central America, and that there are a lot of, we have a sizable amount of immigrants and migrants that come from Africa and West Indian countries, which is something that we don't talk about in our national rhetoric or our state rhetoric around immigration reform. We only talk as if immigrants come from Mexico and Central America. And that is not the case.
No, I hear you on that. So definitely expanding the lens and bringing these important perspectives to the table. You know, Jasmine Kanick, we appreciate you taking time out this afternoon. What do you want people that are listening to do around this case with Ed Buck and Jamel Moore, and I'm not sure the other gentleman's name who they found, because it's...
We don't know his name yet, but I'm just telling people, I'm not an organization, but I know there are some organizations that are getting involved. I know Black Lives Matter in Los Angeles is really... they have been on this since Jamel Moore was killed at Ed Buck. So Black Lives Matter tomorrow in LA, they're going to be leading a protest in front of Jackie Lacey's office, calling on her to prosecute Ed Buck. I'm going to continue to keep people aware as best I can, usually mostly through my social media, about how they can contact the sheriff's department and how they can contact the district attorney's office and ask them to do their job, to arrest Ed Buck and prosecute Ed Buck and then let a jury convict Ed Buck. And we're not going to let it go, because what's going to happen is, if we let this go, rest assured, there will be a third person. There will be a third person.
Real talk right there, and we appreciate you taking time out. We're going to take a break here on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
Hard Knock Radio, East, West, North, South, conectados. Every set, every hood, barrio to barrio. Y'all stand up, stay righteous, speaking to the thugs. One love, we know where y'all at. Brown Buffalo. It's a hard knock life, gotta pay your bills. They want a song about bling, but it ain't real. We speak to the kids and the OGs. Organize, mobilize, be the change you wanna see. 415 bumping Hard Knock Radio. Brown Buffalo, all up in your stereo. And to the youth, live life like it's golden. Go dumb, go hard, but don't forget where you're going. We from the hood, so it's all to the good. Let us know this, what you're feeling is right. Let's get this understood. It's only one reason why we here today. We trying to make real music so the people can relate.
Learning from these hard knocks, slipping in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the poor guy. Learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, ripping to the hard side. Learning from the hard knocks, living in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the poor guy. Learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, ripping to the hard side.
Is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month we'll screen Don't Look Back on Thursday, January 10th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. Don't Look Back is a documentary film following Bob Dylan during a three-week concert tour of England in the spring of 1965. The film chronicles Dylan's concert appearances, hotel room conversations, and downtime, pulling back the curtain on Dylan on the cusp of his creative shift towards rock music. Again, that's Don't Look Back on Thursday, January 10th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOOK Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Ken Stringfellow and John Auer from the Posies on Thursday, January 17th at 8 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall in Portland. John Auer and Ken Stringfellow play Posies songs with a focus on the compositions, melodies, and harmonies. There'll be two guitars, two voices, and the occasional piano. Again, that's Ken Stringfellow and John Auer from the Posies on Thursday, January 17th at 8 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. This is an all-ages event. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hey, 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 what is going on out there? KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM here in Portland, Oregon, Hood River, Columbia Gorge. You're listening in at 91.9 FM. Philomath, Corvallis, Albany, hello to you at 104.3 FM and worldwide. Welcome to you all at www.kboo.fm. No matter where you're listening from, welcome. It is time now for another edition of Drinking from Puddles. I'm Brandon. Glad to be here tonight. We'll be here till 10 with lots of music, some new, some old, some what have you. Be prepared. We're going to start with something that I've been featuring lately by the guitarist Gwennifer Raymond. Her CD that we've been hearing from is called You Were Never Much of a Dancer on the Tompkins Square record label. And it's from 2018, if you can remember back that far. but we're still listening, and we haven't heard this one yet. It's called Bleeding Finger Blues, I believe. It's Gwennifer Raymond. It's here for you on listener-supported Drinking from Puddles and KBOO Portland. Thank you so much for tuning in tonight.